Thank you for joining us again for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. Satellite Nation is a weekly call-in show geared towards the hobby side of all things television. Brought to you by Satellite Guys Radio. Now here are your hosts, Michael and Brian.
Good evening, Satellite Nation. I'm Brian Gore, a.k.a. Titanium.
And I'm Michael Graves, K-E-4-E-S-T.
We're taking a brief into the summer break this evening, and so we're going to be playing two interviews back for you. The first one will be with Syed Farim. He is the founder and CEO of OuterNet, and then the second half of the show, we're going to be playing back an interview with Jeff Wataska, Vice President, Business Development at LTN. Sit back, enjoy the show, and we'll catch you next week on another Satellite Nation. Joining Michael and I this evening is Syed Karim, founder and CEO of OuterNet. Good evening.
Good evening. How are you?
We're doing great. Thank you for joining us this evening. Could you briefly describe what is OuterNet?
So OuterNet is a broadcast data service that is universally accessible geostationary satellites on KU band.
In a connected world like we live in now, what is the purpose? What is the need for OuterNet?
Yes, I do believe that we live in a hyper-connected world, and I am, of the privileged fraction of humanity that gets to live in that. But when it comes down to it, there's probably only about a third of us that get to say that. And so naturally that leaves two-thirds who really have no idea of the type of information and the breadth of knowledge that we all have access to and that take for granted. And so the reason why this is important is because this allows us to offer a significant amount of information to those who would not otherwise have it.
Now, who developed the OuterNet idea?
It's a problem that I've been thinking about for probably on the order of about 6 years. I had originally went to graduate school at the University of Illinois, thinking that I wanted to pursue a PhD. It ended up being that I realized I was not an academic, but my area of interest was the econometrics of information and essentially how information access impacts the quality of life and the economic output of a society. So that's an area that stuck with me for many years. And as I went off into consulting, as I went off into working in media, and then also in working in private equity or investments, it's really just a matter of a problem set that I've always been aware of. And when I finally, and in about the last year or so, realized that it was time for me to start something of my own. And when it's a matter of starting something, it's also a matter of identifying a problem. So that's always with me. I've lived in several different countries and, lived over over the U.S. as well. And so this is something that, just felt that, offering a universal information service, regardless of infrastructure or income was a problem set that, was interesting to me, and that was also was an opportunity. I think it's a huge business opportunity, and so that's how it originated.
So around 2008 is when you started developing the idea.
So I wouldn't necessarily say that I was developing the idea. What I had identified was the problem and how to define it. I don't think I actually came to an idea on what the best way to solve it was for another, 5 or 6 years. It was about, this is 2014, September. I would say about 16, 17 months ago is when I start thinking, I know how to solve this problem. I know what's realistic. I know what things cost. I know what technology looks like. I know what research is. I know what development is. I know what risk is. And that's really what it came about. So I would say, on the order of about a year and a half ago was when much of this, came together.
OuterNet is a one-way push of information, of something that someone requests and then you provide it to them. Is that correct?
So there's two parts right there. It is a one-way push. It's a broadcast data service. Even though it's broadcast, the more appropriate term would be an interactive broadcast. And so when you just said that someone requests, when someone makes a request, like for example, on internet services, there's always that, with packets, there's the acknowledgement that the packets have been received is at the individual level. And so for OuterNet, that's actually something that doesn't happen. It's a broadcast service. There's no acknowledgement. And so we just push information. We push data. The way that it works though is that it's not as if there are some, editors or gatekeepers in London or New York that are saying, hey, the world is going to consume X, Y, or Z content. What we do is we use a different return path. for understanding demand of content or demand of topics or demand of interest. And so we use the crowd internationally to be able to determine what should be pushed out over transponders.
Now, on your site, I see mention of democratically chosen library of content. What does that mean?
So what that means is it kind of goes back to what I just mentioned about, you know, no gatekeepers or editors in chief, in the Middle East, Southern Africa, whatever. It's ultimately, it shouldn't be about individuals that are determining what the topic of conversation is or what people want to consume. It should be individuals. And so when we talk about a separate return path of information, what I mean by that is that in much of the world, I would say it's the number right now is about 75% of the world is covered by a GSM network. Of course, the U.S. is an anomaly with GSM and, you know, other formats. But for outside the U.S., it's mostly GSM. But the thing to keep in mind that that doesn't necessarily mean 3G or 4G. It's, you know, oftentimes what 3G GSM still means is just GPRS. However, GPRS actually can do a whole lot. And 75% of humanity can offer some kind of a vote as to what they want, and especially if it doesn't cost them anything, then that's a valuable service for us. And so what that means as far as democratically chosen, different paths to than what is typical when it comes to satellite communications or SATCOM is we allow people to use, let's say, Facebook Zero or SMS, USSD, email, Twitter, whatever it ends up being. Now, those are all things that most of those are saying, oh, okay, well, those are actually internet services. Well, they're internet services, but in many places of the world, those are actually free internet services. And the reason for that is because the telcos realize that it's in their best interest to offer kind of a taste of the internet so that people buy data services. But for our purposes, it allows people to go ahead and essentially cast their ballot in terms of what kind of content they want distributed, higher bandwidth content, higher volume content over satellites. And that's exactly the way we operate.
Now, on your website, I see something you refer to it as the information priority list. Now, would that be data that people have basically voted for or put in a request for, and you see that there is an interest in that type of data, and so it moves into that priority list? Or tell us more about that.
So the information priority list is based on demand collected in the field by users or interest. And that's what we use to determine what content should be selected and sent out. And it's not just a matter of individual pieces of content. For example, if we see that there is a 20% demand in soccer scores, then it's not as if we just say, oh, well, we're going to go ahead and take the BBC website and just send that. We'll actually take several of them, including the Wikipedia one, so that people have different perspectives on the same topic. So that's what the priority list indicates, is really demand. And then ultimately at the demand that actually flows into the archive that's presented and broadcast over satellites.
Yeah, so what is the current technology you're using to distribute the information from Outernet through the satellites? And I see you right now are using G19 in North America and Hotbird 8 over in Western Europe.
That's correct. So right now, the goal was to be able to be as standards-based as possible, to be hit as many people as there were installed users. And so definitely North America was it's funny compared to much of the world because of the DVB-S standard and also also because of the penetration that, you know, DirecTV and Dish networks have here. Yes, G19, we're on, I don't remember. It's like 10.9 and I don't remember the rest, but, and Hotbird in Europe, and MENA, we go all the way out. Of course, you know, Hotbird has a great, you know, footprint, all the way out to Moscow even. When we move past, our current kind of, technical development stage, we'll go past two transponders. We'll eventually be on either 7 or 8 to have, mostly, I think we'll hit like on the order of about 92 to 94% of humanity. That'll include, most likely AsiaSat 5 on their C-band and their various reasons in China, because that actually makes more sense on C-band, because they have in many of the apartment buildings, C-band dishes on them, which pipe in, over cable, that input, and that's an installed user people. Then in South Asia, I think it's ABS2, is the most popular. And that's really kind of, you'll see a trend, is that it's really just go wherever the most, number of free to air channels exist, and where people are already pointing their dishes. And so in, Central Asia, Northern Asia, it ends up being Yamal 200 or 300, in the South Pacific or Oceania, it ends up being, Optus 2D, and then Hispasat 1E in Latin America. And I may be leaving some. Oh, I left out Africa. There's actually a toss up there. I think our best bang for the buck is going to be Intelsat 20, IS 20 in that region. So that after getting all of those, we'll be hitting, you'll be hard pressed to find a place in the world where we're not covering.
Now, what you're talking about are basically geosynchronous satellites. So with those, user does need to have a dish and receiving software. But it looks like what you're talking about is that you're going to use these downlinks as kind of hubs to feed other distribution methods.
Sure. Yeah. So we're leaving the problem set is regarded as the last mile. For us, it's not really the last mile. It's almost like the last couple feet. And what I mean by that is that, the most prevalent radio RF system that exists right now in the world with 10 billion of these radios is Wi-Fi. And so instead of requiring someone to have a television, and piping the receiver back into some kind of a larger screen, what we realize is that, if you look at mobile penetration, if you look at, even laptops, that's really where, the technology trend and user adoption is. And so what we're saying is, hey, you know what? All of those nowadays, and even for the past 3 or 4 years, it's been standard Wi-Fi. So we're just going to go ahead and create a system that has an Wi-Fi and distribute all that content, from a local web server over Wi-Fi.
Okay. So this data is continuously streaming, and I imagine it's then archived locally, and then it's accessed somehow. So once this data comes down, could you describe the process that someone would access that data?
Sure, not a problem. So we have a very open philosophy when it comes to both hardware and software. We're looking for our entire stack of software to be open source, and definitely when it comes to the hardware, we will eventually be manufacturing some, but by no means do we care if you buy it from us or from anyone else, and we'll even identify all the different components that are compatible, and we'll write software for that as well. We think the value really is in having a pervasive in terms of service, rather than going down the path of conventional SATCOM and saying, oh, you have to buy our stuff, and we have to have our proprietary hardware and software stack on it. So as far as the path goes is, what's really required, of course, you have to have your, 60-plus centimeter dish, your LNB, and then that's all standard. And then it gets down to what is kind of special, or not special, but what is required to receive Outernet. We will eventually have an Android app, because we've noticed that many of the modern set-top boxes are going towards Android. We've looked at the API, and they've exposed the levers that we need in order to be able to send our MPEG, fully qualified MPEG to transport stream that has that's really leveraging the ancillary data layer. And sending it through Android and using some software to be able to say, here's a stream, now we need to turn that stream into a file. As it works right now is we've focused on basically one solution, and the reason we focus on that one is because it's very hacker oriented and open source and maker oriented, and that's using a Raspberry Pi and all the different parts of the Pi that work really well, both operating system and also the 802.11 radios that you can buy for $8 and which turn that Raspberry Pi into a hotspot. So right now, you hook into a DVB-S tuner that is Linux compatible. There's a whole set of them. If you look at linuxtv.org, they go ahead and outline all the USB tuners. We've identified what is most likely probably the least expensive of the bunch. And of course, there are many more that we will be testing, future. So, we have the drivers and also the software that's freely available to be able to turn that file into a stream. You flash, or create a copy of the operating system, whether it's Arch Linux or whether it's Raspbian. What happens there is we make sure we insert the packages that allow it hotspot and also have our stream to file software. And then at that point, once everything's up and running with, like I had mentioned earlier, it's no simple task as of right now, but eventually it will be. But once everything is in place, all the software is in place, then it's just a matter of connecting to the Outernet network. And if you'll notice on the website, there's the how-to section. And it has a couple of links back to the GitHub account and where all the software repos are. But what I think is most important is look at the video. It's about a minute 30, and it shows the entire system in operation. You know, says, okay, well, here's the dish LNB coax coming back onto a Raspberry Pi, and then shows the user connecting to the outernet network, and then you see the pages and the web server display all the content that is in the folders or the download directory.
Very good. So what we're referencing here for everyone listening is the website for Outernet, and that's www.outernet.is. So that's www.outernet.is. And on that page, you're going to find links to their Twitter, Facebook, Google social accounts. So I visited your site, some very good information on there, very informative, very good job on that. Now, once that data comes down, and it's, I imagine, archived on an attached hard drive, then you'll have some sort of a library or indexing system that the local users can access that data that's been filling this hard drive?
That's correct. So naturally, that user experience is really driven by open source software. So yes, there's a UX that we have, but you know, anyone can go ahead and just go to the directory level and see what do LS and see everything that pops out. But our user experience is something that we call Librarian, and Librarian offers kind of a view of loaded, what has been favorited. It gives you a kind of a timestamp of various things. And in the future, it'll say, hey, we have a new software update, and you can choose to install it if you want to. And of course, there'll be more features like, for example, tagging, which allows you to say, hey, I'm interested in politics, I'm interested in sports. Go ahead and throw everything else away. Those are the only things I'm interested in, and save those locally. I'm interested in Russian content and Russian content about literature. And so you just go ahead and create those tags, and those are the only things that get saved locally. Or, of course, like you've mentioned, yes, there is the ability to index all the content locally. That is actually a feature that hasn't been built out just yet. And the major reason for that is that, we're trying to focus this on being very limited, as far as hardware goes, limited in terms of specs. And so we want to make sure that we're not taxing the hardware in any way. So it's also it's something that we want to offer that works well before just offering something that doesn't work at all.
You just answered what I was going to ask you, because if you've got a – so you got a hard drive, it's X amount of gigabytes or whatever, and if it keeps storing this stuff, it's eventually going to have a bunch of stuff maybe you don't want on there. So that's what I was going to ask is – and you answered that with the tagging. And then what you're saying is it deletes the rest of it off the hard drive that you don't want?
Correct. So actually, when it comes to the tagging feature and you start to – state what your interests are. Those files that aren't in line with that taxonomy, they're not even ever saved. So basically, the local client looks at files and says, oh, okay, well, this isn't about sports, this isn't about weather, throw it away. And that's a way to be able to make the best use out of your limited storage. And then storage can be one of two ways. One can be hard drive. Hard drives are pretty cheap with the amount of space that they have available. Or, my has a micro SD, and I only have 4 gigs available, and so everything stays over there. So it's really kind of determining or understanding what various use cases are and designing around that. But also, there's a feature set that is actually not released just yet. But one of the feature is, at what point in time do I save stuff and just throw it away? So you mark and saying, hey, my archive stuff I keep indefinitely, or my favorite archive stuff, it only stays in there for 2 weeks or for 4 weeks. And one of the things that you'll notice when you see Librarian is that it has very prominently displayed saying, this is the amount of space that you have left. So you have to determine what you want in it and what you don't want in your library.
Very, very interesting. Now, I do have one question. Is this family safe? What determines what information is getting pushed?
Yeah, no, you. So to answer your question off the bat, one is, yes, it's family safe. But the other side of it introduces another not an easy question or even problem, which is, one thing that we don't want to do is act as a censor. We have no desire. As a matter of fact, one of the founding principles of not just Outernet, but also, my graduate work was at the University of Illinois, School of Library and Information Sciences. So, and in the U.S., one of the founding principles for that field is that no library should act as a sensor. It's a matter of the end user or the public determine what they want to and don't want to consume at an individual level. And so, you know, family safe, yes, I think that's really fundamentally important. But, you know, once you get past, there's just some things that I think we can all agree that, you know, probably should not be exposed to everyone at large. But once you get past, you know, things of that adult nature, then it goes into the items like, hey, if there is a lot of demand to be for people to be able to explore or understand the topic, I don't. And we have internally discussed how to properly determine how to, you know, distribute that information, disseminate it. But in some cases, it's going to be really kind of dicey. And I mean, we're going to actually ask our community to help us to find the answer, because that's the only way.
And I really appreciate your candor with this. You know, right now, it looks like it's quite techy for someone to get into this. You know, Michael and I were talking about this, and, you know, he has a lot of interest in Raspberry, et cetera, and so he has a lot of interest. But, you know, for the average person, right now it does feel a bit techy. What steps are you taking to offer a solution for people that maybe aren't attracted to the technology, but they want the information?
If you look at the technology adoption curve for basically anything in the last 30 years, you'll see the forefront is also those who are like just knee deep and want to see the zeros and ones. And that's where we are really right now, kind of immersed. And that's why we really chose the Raspberry Pi community, because they like to tinker with stuff. They like to, and they're perfectly fine with something that doesn't work exactly like the documentation states, right? But yeah. That's we know that that's not where the knee or that inflection point is. And that inflection point is really where you turn something into a solid consumer product, and that's what we're headed towards. For example, I've mentioned before with Android, we can offer like in the Google Play store an application that you can download from to an Android based set top box. And I know that let's say for example, I think the guy, he's a really sharp guy, and I know that he's been involved in the North American free-to-air community. I forget what the name of the company is, but they just recently released a fairly inexpensive Android-based set-top box, and we think we can write some software at the application layer that just allows you to go ahead and download it, and then you're able to download out-of-net content, and it works, and it turns everything into a hotspot, and it'll work, hopefully, turnkey. So that's really what we need. We need something that's just a matter of, like, your iTunes experience. On the other side of things is being able to repurpose existing stuff in a very consumer-oriented fashion as well, which is, let's say, we want to be able to plug in a inexpensive DVB-S tuner to a router, to your Linksys router, right? Anything that can run something called OpenWRT or Tomato, these are all open-source wireless operating systems. Anything that can run those stuff should be able to run our entire stack. And at that point, I mean, you're talking about having a set-top box that is acting as a local wireless local area network, $30. It's going to be hard to beat that price point. So, and we think we can do it to a point to where it's like, hey, just download this, flash this, and you know, 1, 2, 3, you're done. And then, of course, I think the real end goal is saying everyone can play with all this stuff though however they want to. We'll give the best instructions that we know how. But ultimately, you know, you really want to go to the store. Some people want to go to the store and pay $50, whether it's online or on Amazon, or if it's whether it's in Nigeria, whether it's in Kenya, whether it's in Bangladesh or in Siberia. You know, there should be a reseller that's going to say, hey, you know what? Here's this box, just works. You plug it in and it just goes ahead, listens to the signal and turns it into a hotspot. That's really where the win is at the end of the day. And we're a ways away from that. But I mean, ultimately, like I said, the whole process is very open in nature, and we would love for, you know, the community to help us get there even faster.
So you're eventually going to yourself try to develop something yourself that you can just sell, that's just plug and play.
Sure. So, I mean, I know how difficult it is to make hardware. I've worked in product development before, and it is by no means an easy task. And distribution is even harder, especially in many of the markets that we want to be in. So I hesitantly say yes, although I would just really love if there was someone else who was better at this stuff to come over and take over and go ahead and be better at it. So ultimately, what we want to do is provide that information service and focus our efforts there. But we know that we need to see the market with hardware in order for it first to get there. You know, if DMSI wants to ever push something out, or if Shenzhen builds something that ends up costing $20 and does the exact same thing, hey, then great, please do it. But until that happens, you know, we have to go ahead, step up, and do it.
Right.
Now, I see your funding is coming from Media Development Investment Fund. What can you tell us about this?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, I can actually tell you quite a bit about it. So I kind of mentioned the list of things that I've done before starting Outernet, and I had been the manager of a fund. It was a seed fund for early stage startups at Media Development Investment Fund. And what is not unheard of at various types of investment funds is that, you know, some of the principals will go off and say, hey, it's time for me to do my own thing. And then, you know, there's a good relationship and say, okay, well, you know, if it's in line with what we invest in, then I think maybe we should invest. So that's where the existing relationship was. What Media and Development Investment Fund is an impact investment fund. And what they've been doing for almost 20 years is investing in independent media throughout the world, and actually in really difficult markets related to free press and access to information. So they're investing in newspapers in southern Russia and Siberia that aren't owned by oligarchs or aren't owned by the state government or the government. And they're also like Macedonia, you know, Zimbabwe, South Africa, Indonesia, Malaysia. You know, basically anywhere there's a trying environment, they're the ones who step up and say, you know what, we'll take a chance on journalists, we'll take a chance on media entrepreneurs, and we'll go ahead and stake a claim, stake something in the ground and say that we believe in this and we think there's both a need from a societal aspect and also market opportunity. And so that's what they've been doing, is providing accessible financing for media entrepreneurs for the past 20 years.
Very good. Now, listeners have an opportunity to get involved with your company. So if somebody's listening tonight, they like the concept, they like what they're hearing, how can they get involved with Outernet?
So I'll tell you what, we're not here to hawk any of our wares. You know, maybe someday we will be, but right now it's a matter of, we want to be able to put together the best service that is possible. And it's not just a matter of the bits flying through the air, but I mean, it's an entire user experience. And so we want to make sure everything works and works all over the place. So if you, wherever you are in North America, that's the assumption, is that you are, but wherever you are, you know, if you feel that you can put together the requisite material to be able to download stuff, then please do let us know. Post on our forums. Don't send us a direct email, because direct emails don't get shared. Whereas if you're at discuss.outernet.is, then everyone else can be able to learn from what you've been able to come together and put together. So, I mean, like right now we have a gentleman in the UK, and he was saying, hey, you know what? I just bought all the kit. Now I'm going to go through the process and fully document whether or not your instructions work. And then I'll go ahead and let you know what signal quality is like and whether things are actually getting downloaded and how long it actually takes. So if people did that throughout North America, it would really be a benefit, because we're really kind of in the dark. Essentially, it's just a few of the core team who's in North America. And you know, but there's just so – it's G19. I mean, it goes from – what is it? From the southern borders of Canada all the way into the Caribbean. So
it goes all the way from Alaska, northern Canada, all the way through Mexico. In the Caribbean. So yes, G19 definitely has coverage.
Yeah, and we would like to be able to see how coverage reacts. And also another thing is that if what's even better, this would be more powerful, is if any of your listeners knew of how to solve an information access problem. I know, you know, I have a skew of what life is and all over, you know, the U.S., but for example, in some disconnected communities, if they want something, you know, relay it to us. Like, we'll send books, we'll send Khan Academy videos. Basically, if it's in an internet packet, you know, we'll go ahead and send it off. So if there's demand for something, you know, we're not at the point where we're strictly following. I mean, there's limited users on the demand aggregation side, so we can go ahead and make and heed individual requests. So tell us, you know, what books you want or whatever it is, and we can send them everywhere. And then you can also let us know that if they actually, you know, got delivered in there, it's entirely. So, you know, what's more important now than anything is just kind of some feedback as to whether what we're talking about is working.
All right. You know, something about when I first heard your service was, I knew that you're going to be on satellite, that you're going to be putting out this data. It sounded interesting what you were doing, but I didn't really see how it applied to me and my interests. But the more you talk about it, I see, you know, a lot of interest where I could, you know, tie in my my interest of the satellite along with you know, some computer stuff and a card and that sort of thing. But it sounds like you're going way beyond you know, just asking us to see if we can receive the signal.
Oh yeah, I mean, there are many puzzles to play with here. RF, there's when I say RF, it's a matter of, hey, we want to be able to make this as small and portable as possible, because that's, you know, that's really what a consumer product is about. So there's different dish designs, pedalization, things of that nature. There's software, like almost most of what we're using right now is open source, but there's a little small freeware layer that's not open source, but we're working towards open sourcing that. And, you know, that's a puzzle in itself. And so we're going to ask for people's help and also just feedback on whether, you know, what we come up with actually works.
Right now, Wade, is right now, could I use, say, any Linux computer or, say, BeagleBone? You know, it's like the Raspberry Pi.
To answer your question, a BeagleBone should work. You know, any flavor of an ARM development board will work. But getting down to an, unfortunately, right now, a Linux laptop, that's not just yet. It's definitely high priority, but just not there just yet.
Okay, yeah, that answered my question on that.
And then, of course, what we have been talking about is our higher speed KU band service, but that's not the end all be all. We're really moving towards a mobile service as well, and it'll be a different service. But and we're hoping that will our first iteration of it will be available in the first quarter of the next year. And so, what that will allow is, you know, a similar experience to what the KU band service offers right now, but go directly to a device. It's not going straight to an iPhone or an Android, but with a, you know, an RF front end, it will be able to use something like, let's say, a receiver that is equivalent to a square credit card reader, you know, like a dongle that goes through the 3.5 millimeter audio jack. By using that, our target is to eventually be able to push between 50 and 100 megabytes a day to everyone in the world directly to a mobile device. Now, granted, that takes a little bit, that's a different kind of infrastructure that's involved, but, you know, there's a need for a lower speed mobile service that goes directly to the end user and also a higher speed library service that creates this great archive. So we think we're, you know, the goal is to be able to create very realistically and very possibly a library in every home and a bookshelf in every pocket.
Wow, that sounds fantastic. You know, I'm just going to drive everybody to visit www.outernet.is. That's www.outernet.is. And there's a great forum on there. It looks like it's very active. I read through that some, and looks like there's a lot of information being exchanged back and forth there. So, you know, I'll just say, guys, if this is something that interests you, we have listeners in Europe, we have listeners all over the world. If this is something that interests you, check out their website, get involved, play with the technology, give them feedback. And it will be really exciting to see where this project does go. As individuals, what can we do to help promote you, to promote the information about what you're trying to do? Are you to that point where you want people using social media to get behind and start talking about you?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think the most important thing that people could do in social media is we have something that's going on. It's called a thunderclap. And essentially what that means is at the same time, on the same date, everyone will go ahead and announce the same piece of content. And what that does is has like a viral and ripple effect across the entire internet. And so we're making a big announcement on September 4th, and the current thunderclap. So if you just Google thunderclap and Outernet, and you make sure that it's thunderclap and information for the world from outer space, talking about it, describes the whole process. And what that'll happen, the impact of that will be, it'll be multiplicative. And what I mean by that is that the reason why the thunderclap is so important is that it gets right now we have a million people as being a part of the reaction of the thunderclap, and just adding your support, you know, through social media, whether it's Facebook or through Twitter, really it multiplies your entire audience and sequence it across that message that's being displayed at the same time. We're gonna have this big announcement, and I have a really sharp video that I think is incredibly compelling on September 4th, which really hits back to the fact that, you know, we want to be humanity's public library. And, you know, going back to that earlier Frank discussion, was like, hey, we want to make sure that we're solving that issue when it comes to censorship and also information access, universal information access. And that, I think hopefully that video goes a long way to be able to describe that. And well, if anyone wanted to participate in that.
Well, very good. Thank you so much, Syed Karim, founder and CEO of OuterNet. We want to thank you for being on the show this evening and letting our listeners know a little bit about OuterNet. Today I'm talking with Jeff Wetaska, Vice President, Business Development, LTN Global Communications. Thank you for joining us today, Jeff.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to talk to you.
Now, a little bit about you and the history and what we're going to be talking about tonight. For many years, we've known each other in the satellite industry. But a few years ago, I know you joined another company, and we're going to be talking about that company this evening. But let's kind of give a big overall view of what satellite distribution is used for and what IP distribution is used for.
Well, there's kind of a convergence right now, Brian. Satellite for many, many years and through today is used mainly for point-to-point live events and for point-to-multipoint, where you're talking, you know, one signal going to many people. Over the past couple of years, IP's really kind of taken a foothold. And there's a gentleman I know, one of our clients said to me, Jeff, I was hoping to retire before this IP generation would come to the forefront, but he's too late. He's still there, and IP's really kind of taken over. So satellite is still there, but IP is a technology that is really growing and, again, has a good foothold in the marketplace.
Now, just so everybody knows, you're not just an IP salesman. I mean, you and I go back many, many years. What, about, I think about 15 years.
Yeah, about 15. It's been a long time.
Now, you previously were with Pittsburgh Communications as the chief sales officer. Now, while you were there, satellite was the reigning distribution. Now, what is causing this change from satellite to IP?
Well, a number of reasons, Brian, is first of all, satellite does have limitations. There's latency issues, especially when talking live news. Everyone's seen that feed come from Europe when the Bill O'Reillys or the Larry Kings of the world would ask a question, and it would take a second or two for someone to respond. So that's the first thing with that. And the second thing is, technology just is moving forward. And today you can use IP. It's a standard that everyone's getting used to. And it's a worldwide opportunity versus, satellites only cover about a third of the world. So by using our technology, you can take feeds anywhere in the world without having to worry about bouncing off of multiple satellites, which reduces cost. And that's really what people are looking at, is reducing cost as well as ease of use.
So let's dig into exactly what is LTN Global Communications. What services do you provide to your customers? So let's approach this from the person. Let's just assume the person listening to us today never has heard of IP distribution. So let's kind of give a primer for them.
Sure. Well, LTN Global can be compared to a satellite company and compared to a fiber company, because we do both point-to-point and point-to-multipoint. The technology we use is IP, but what makes LTN different than the old, software or a box-to-box type solution is that LTN is the only company that has a fully managed private IP backbone network. We have a series of what we call super nodes located throughout the world, and these are our own nodes that we mesh together with our own private bandwidth, so that instead of riding on the open internet with IP from a box-to-box or just using software, LTN controls the signal all the way through from the receive point or the send point through the receive point. Now, in addition to that backbone network, instead of having software on somebody's laptop, we put an LTN appliance at both send and receive locations, and our software runs from that appliance to the nearest node on a public IP address. But once it hits our backbone network, then we can route that anywhere in the world on our backbone network that nobody else can do.
Now, what is the benefit to going through your private network rather than going box to box, point to point?
Well, there's the internet was not made for video, number one, and there's no quality of service on the internet. By having our own private IP backbone network, we can control that signal and provide five nines of reliability and give that quality of service that no one else can do. Additionally, because we have that backbone network, we have very low latency on our networks, between 300 and 500 milliseconds, including the encode and the decode. And we don't need big bandwidth issues. So, a lot of these guys, if you're on a box to box, if you're sending a 5 meg signal or a 10 meg signal, you need double, triple, sometimes, 100% more bandwidth.
Right.
In order to send those signals. So you send a lot of packets. LTN only needs a maximum of 25% overhead. So your bandwidth size is a much lower, requirement than compared to the other solutions that are out there.
Okay, so at 25% overhead, let's put this into perspective. Say I am a broadcaster. I'm wanting to get something in the field back to my studio. I'm running just a typical HD camera, let's say 720p, and I just want, good image quality without much, bizarre, blurry, blah, blah, going on in the background. What should I look for when I'm looking for that initial IP, public IP, to get it back to your node?
Good question. But I first want to say, on the LTN network, we correct that fuzziness and that blurriness, as you said, in the backbone, which makes us, you know, unique. Okay. But for an HD signal, our customers are doing anywhere from 5 to 10 megabits per second HD. So you need anywhere from 7 to 12.5 megs of upload speed on that link of public internet to bring it back through the LTN network and bring it back to the broadcast.
Okay. Now, I know in the past, in order to do a backhaul, you'd have to have a dedicated fiber or just a dedicated line. So what you're telling me is, if I have a public internet available where I'm at, there's probably some quality or a level of service that I have to have. But it sounds like it could be linked up anywhere that there's broadband?
Pretty much. We have basically what you need is business class internet with a static IP address. And as long as that can be dedicated to our network, our customers are in good shape. We have customers that are running, 2 or 3 megs, so they have a 5 meg cable modem type upload. And we have other customers that have a dedicated internet of, gigabit traffic. They allocate part of that internet pipe to us. They both work pretty well.
Okay. Now, who are your customers, and why do they use the LTN service?
Well, people, who our customers are. Your listeners will know who our customers are, and you've seen us without even knowing that you've seen the LTN network in use. All the major broadcasters right now use LTN for live shots. We have over 200 studios, live shot studios in the United States. So when you see an expert such as, Dennis Miller, every Wednesday night, I believe, he's on Fox with Bill O'Reilly. I think it's called Miller Time. He's in an LTN-connected studio in California. Bill O'Reilly asked some questions in the New York studio, and they talk live back and forth, just like you and I are talking over this phone line. So all the major broadcasters, Fox, CNN, CNBC, ABC, CBS, NBC, Al Jazeera America, PBS, they all have our appliances and decoders and encoders at their locations, so they can send and receive the LTN signal. The main reason, Brian, is a couple of things. It's quality. It's very high quality. It's worldwide. And cost. We're much less expensive than most of the other live shot companies that are out there. Any one of the broadcasters, when they want to have a guest from that area, will go into our online booking form. We'll select the city, state and city. And then on that online booking form, they will then select the bit rate, the time, the length of the shot, and then hit submit. And at that particular time, LTN turns on and puts the guest in the chair, and all those broadcasters I mentioned before will then start talking to the guest in the studio.
I come from a background of, I roll up in a uplink truck, roll out the cables, hook up a phone line, call in on my cell, and hopefully get a good audio return so the person in the studio can talk to the person in the field. What are the benefits to these live studios over, say, rolling a truck into someone's office?
Well, the main thing is cost. Satellite trucks are expensive, and they're time-consuming. You're having a person get in the truck, drive to wherever the location is. So we have live shot studios, which are public live shots. But we also have corporations that their CEO will get on and talk to, the CNBC guys or Fox Business or CNN. So they – install an LTN appliance with a compatible encoder in their office, mm-hmm. and they're on net. And basically, anytime they want to use us, the network just dials them up. Right. They will pick that company turn on their cameras, and they're connected to LTN.
Interesting.
Now, what else is interesting is we also come up with a fly pack. So we actually, in place of an uplink truck, we can now send a hardened case for with an LTN appliance, an encoder and a decoder and or a decoder to any location that has, again, a static IP address. So for things like NFL training camps or corporate communications or trials that that are going to happen, people have used us, used our fly pack for that instance. And for one of the big ones, I always call it the Super Bowl for Catholics, is a few years back when the Pope retired and the new Pope was being elected at the conclave, Fox News sent instead of an uplink truck using satellite or dedicated fiber, they use the LTN fly pack from Vatican City. So for almost 18 days, Shepard Smith did every live shot from the Vatican City back to Fox News New York, then up on the air using the LTN fly pack. So again, Fox News counted on us to deliver. That's a big news story, and we did deliver.
Excellent. Okay. Now, you talk about fly packs, and I'm from the satellite background. I remember these fly packs that would be shipped out to me. It was something, as a camera operator, I typically wouldn't be setting up. There would be a RF tech that would come in and do the setup for me. Is it that difficult with your fly packs?
No, not really. It's plug and play. We get information, the IP configuration form, we call it, prior to the event. We pre-program that into the fly pack, and we ship it to the location. So you don't need a tech, because what happens, Brian, is once you get to that location, you basically plug it in, turn it on, and plug in your internet connection, and then it shows up on our network. So our guys back at the NOC, our technicians, which we do have a 24/7 NOC, can log into that location, into that appliance, and they can do any configurations and any testing without having to spend the money to fly somebody there. Wow. Now, we have had some occasions where, you know, people do send it with the technician, but that is really not necessary. It depends on the level of comfort of the people that are at that particular location.
So what you're telling me is if I get to the location and I'm having some trouble configuring to get back to you, you're able to then remotely do something?
Yes. First of all, again, the fly pack's pre-configured. Mm-hmm. But if there's an issue, there's also a modem in the fly pack. So our guys can dial in, and then from that way they can configure the fly pack.
Wow. Very good. Okay. Now, we had talked about CNN. Now, I understood that a recent network launch used a fly pack from, you mentioned the Bahamas.
That was actually an event that just occurred last week where the SEC network was launching on ESPN. From the Bahamas. It was the Kentucky basketball team was down there, and they mm-hmm. played several games. But because of some uplink issues on satellite, rain fade mainly on the KU side, fiber not being available on the island, they selected to use the LTN fly pack. And LTN delivered the Kentucky basketball games back to ESPN. And, we went on the main network as well as ESPN3, ESPNU. The signal was very good, and the ESPN was very happy with it.
Very interesting. Okay, now, fly packs. Are they difficult to get a hold of, difficult to book? What time frame is involved if I wanted to schedule an event, get a fly pack out there, and go live back to my broadcast studio?
Well, we have an inventory of fly packs, and depending on, what's going on in the world or how many are booked, they're usually available. And I always say, Brian, we do what's best for the customer. Our engineers don't like to hear that. Again, I'm not an engineer, I'm the sales side. But, we've done stuff very quickly. But we usually say a week or 2 weeks, prior, as long as you have some advanced knowledge, we pre-program it, ship it, make sure it gets there tested. But we've done things on much shorter notice. Again, the engineers don't like to do that, as any engineer, whether you're a satellite engineer or a fiber engineer, you always want to make sure it works fine. And that's something about the LTN network. We pride ourselves on having very high quality signals. So we want to make sure the signals are good, and we don't want to do anything that degrades not only the signal, but the customer satisfaction with that signal. So, as much time as we can get, we'll take. But we can do things on short notice if needed.
Now, we're mostly talking to this point about backhaul services. What else? What other services do you provide other than just backhaul?
Well, we provide a couple other services. We're talking about OU services right now, occasional use services. We're talking backhaul. We work with corporations such as Microsoft, where we take they use our fly packs back to Redmond for broadcast, and they actually convert that into their backbone network for their web-based system. So we do that kind of services. We also do point to multipoint. We do distribution deals. We're connected to DirecTV, for example. We connect, and that's kind of a backhaul service, but it's a full-time signal back to DirecTV. And we have several customers such as Lilly Broadcasting, where we do a full-time distribution where we'll take their signal from their feed out of Erie, Pennsylvania, and drop it off to multiple cable head ends in the Caribbean, mainly Puerto Rico and St. Lucia and some other locations. We also drop that signal off to DirecTV. And what's unique about the LTN network, Brian, is you ingest a 10 meg signal. And by the way, our signal can be SD, HD, 4K, 3D. It doesn't make a difference. It's all bandwidth to us, as long as it's an MPEG transport stream. But once you ingest that signal, say 10 megabits, it's in our network at 10 megabits. So we can drop it off at multiple locations at 10 megabits in each location. So, if you're going to 10 sites, you don't need 10 times 10 on your bandwidth. You don't need 100 megs of bandwidth. You need the 10 megs one time, and then we drop it off at each location simultaneously anywhere in the world at 10 megabits.
Which is an important consideration, because if you're doing a live from an event, you are going to probably be very limited to the amount of bandwidth available to up. So if you're going point to point, you're pretty much out of the game after you get one or two sites signing in to watch your stream.
That's correct. And that's not the way it is with us. Again, you ingest it one time, we drop it off in multiple locations.
Okay. Now, going through your website, I saw some terms like smart cloud. What is, you know, everything is a cloud this, iCloud, you know, everything that I have is basically connected to the cloud. Not sure why or for what reason, but it sounds cool. What is smart cloud?
Well, smart cloud is basically our private, fully managed private IP backbone network. That is our series of supernodes that are, again, right over top. So it's kind of cloud-based that you connect via that appliance and then connect through the a local internet connection. So our smart cloud is not the open internet, but it's our private, fully managed network. And the only way to get into that network is to have one of our appliances. So, you know, to hack into it, it's just not like open internet. You have security on that level, as well as we also have encryption on our network. That if some of our customers do decide to use that, that's a function of our appliance. They can, we can turn that on. So from the ingestion at the send site, it gets encrypted all the way through the last mile to our smart cloud, our backbone network. It's encrypted all the way through our network. Then on the receive side, it's encrypted all the way through that last mile to our appliance. It gets unencrypted. So there's several layers of encryption, you know, that way. I do also want to mention our network's fully redundant. And, you know, a lot of times what happens on fiber is you're going to a point to point. If something happens to that fiber, you're out of luck. On satellite, if it rains, you've got that one point, you're out of luck. By using the last mile of an internet connection, we can then determine where our software determines where that signal gets sent. So let's say I'm in Pittsburgh. I'm sending a signal from Pittsburgh to Los Angeles, and it goes, you know, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Denver, LA. That's through our super nodes going out to LA. But something happens in Chicago. You know, it's oversubscribed because we get a lot of business coming out of Chicago at that time, or there's a fire at the NOC. Well, our network automatically senses that and says, I'm not going to go to Chicago. I'm going to send it through Atlanta. So we go Pittsburgh, Atlanta, Denver, LA, and the customer never sees that. And because of that built-in redundancy, you know, our network, knock on wood, has really never gone down. You know, in the past, a few years back, you may remember Netflix was off the air for 3 or 4 hours because the Akamai backbone went down.
Right.
Because something happened in the Washington, D.C. area. It was bad storms. Well, we route around that, and that happens automatically. So, you know, while certain nodes, we can pull down certain nodes for maintenance or whatever, we can route around those all the time. So our network really has been, you know, very, very bulletproof.
Now, on latency, when you're doing point to point, I would be sending video, and by the time it travels through from Sacramento to Kansas City to Atlanta and then up to New York, then when the signal gets to New York and some information is missing, then it has to send a signal back to say, hey, resend this data. And then is that what causes a lot of buffering or latency issues on backhauls?
Yes, but not on the LTN network.
Now, how are you different?
Well, because we have the backbone network. You know, the network is very important to the way we do things. So, you know, typically you have to either have much bigger pipes, as I talked about earlier, you know, double, triple, the size of the stream. So you can send a heck of a lot more packets to lower the latency, but you need a lot more bandwidth. On the LTN network, you only need that 25%, up to 25%, because we do node to node. Data recovery. So again, if we're going from Pittsburgh to Chicago to Denver to LA, when it gets to Denver, we said we lost some packets. It doesn't wait till it goes to LA all the way back to Pittsburgh and resend it again. It goes back from Denver back to Chicago and resends that way. So our super nodes are about 10 milliseconds apart. That's how we determine how much bandwidth we need.
Okay.
Again, we have gigabit connections between all our super nodes, but if it gets over that 10 milliseconds, we get more bandwidth between those. So you're only going back, you know, 20 milliseconds round trip instead of going all the way across the country already back again, which adds to the latency.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that. Very good point. Now, what are the benefits to selecting a IP service such as LTN over satellite for a backhaul? You had talked about cost effectiveness. What is the difference in cost?
Well, the difference is, it's hard to put an exact number on there because there's so many variables, Brian, but, you know, bandwidth is one issue. You know, the more bandwidth is a little bit more expensive, especially on satellite. You know, you're talking an HD signal. You're talking about a lot of space on that satellite, 10,
right,
sometimes 20 megabits, especially
right,
for sports. But LTN is much cheaper. So we're anywhere from 25 to 75% cheaper, depending on the bandwidth and the number of locations we can drop the signal off to. I mentioned the full-time services we do distribution. You know, we can do hundreds of sites. So a lot of these channels that are looking at satellite for a distribution deal, you know, may look at LTN now because they can drop it off to multiple sites. You know, if it's not thousands of sites or millions, if you're going to millions of homes, that's where satellite has its place. You know, the direct-to-home type of market, the dishes and DirecTVs. Mm-hmm. That's not where we play. But if you're going to 20 or 30 sites, 40 sites, 50 sites, LTE competes extremely favorable for satellite, and especially we are talking about international feeds, because once, as I said, once you ingest that signal one time, we can drop it off multiple times anywhere in the world. So if you're going to do a feed, a European feed that's going up on, say, Hotbird, but you're also going up on Galaxy 19, two separate locations, well, we can take that signal and ingest it once and drop it off at the same time at Galaxy 19 and at Hotbird, you know, at the uplink facility there. So that's two separate satellites. So if you're going to feed from London or from, you know, the Middle East, you want to bring it back to the United States, that's two uplinks.
Right.
So you're doubling your cost. LTN, you don't do it. That's not the way it works. So we can drop appliances off with decoders anywhere in the world and drop the signal off, and it makes it much more cost effective as compared to satellite.
All right. Now, let's talk about the future. A few minutes ago, you mentioned 4K, 3D. It sounds like the LTN is very scalable. How do you address new formats, new bandwidth requirements that come along?
Well, our technical team, Brian, is second to none. They are always looking at what's coming in the future. So we've been, you know, doing internal testing and preparing for the future. And I'm sure there's things that are working on in our lab right now that I don't know about. So, you know, it always amazes me that whenever one of my clients comes to me and says, Jeff, here's an issue that I have, our guys always seem to have an answer for, because they've already thought about it months and months ago or years ago. So, you know, we're always on the forefront of what's out there. We attend all the conferences. We'll be at IBC. We go to NAB. We're part of the sports video group. We have a whole arm that handles nothing but sports. And that's a growing business for us. So, you know, we're on top of what's going on in the market, and our technical staff, our engineering staff, as I said, is second to none. They're experts in the IP delivery of video. With extremely low latency. So they know what's going on. So we are preparing now for what may happen a year or so from now.
Who are your partners that you work with? Because you don't just do multicast or point-to-point within an IP system. You do work with satellite uplinkers. Why is that important to your business model?
I like to call ourselves a hybrid network. Not that our network itself is hybrid, but it can be part of a hybrid network. We have multiple teleports domestically and internationally that have an LTN appliance and a decoder and encoder. So if we're, for example, a live shot studio may want to do a satellite media tour across the United States, where they're going to be talking to a lot of affiliates that may or may not have the LTN solution, we can backhaul the signal LTN from that studio back to one of our partner teleports, then they can uplink it on satellite. We've done that for Liberty University football games, where they're going to some digital subcarriers. We drop it off, for example, to ESPN through the waterfront switch. The LTN, to Masson via LTN. Last year was the Comcast Sports. They would take it via LTN, but the local affiliates would then pull it off a satellite. So we have satellite partners, again, both here in the United States and internationally. We have several in the Middle East. We've got a couple partners in Italy and in mainland Europe. So we have access to them where we can, you know, when satellite's needed, we can incorporate LTN as a backhaul as part of that. Additionally, we're also part of switching hubs. So, you know, Encompass Waterfront Switch for any broadcasters that aren't a part of LTN, and not many are at this point, but if they're not, we can drop it off the waterfront and people connect with us there. We're also a part of Azure LHD switching hub. We're also part of the Hibernia network. And so we can connect to Vivix through Pittsburgh teleport. We can connect to the switch through waterfront. So we're really connected by having the LTN appliance at any location. Without having to pay monthly fees to connect to all of those locations on a point-to-point fiber connection, we provide that ability for those customers to have access to all those teleports and switching hubs without having to have all those point-to-point connections.
Now, on your website, it says LTN Video Transport Services, the most advanced professional solution for broadcast quality live video transport. Why are you ahead of the other people trying to provide a service?
It goes back to our network. We are the only ones that have the fully managed private IP backbone network. And then, Brian, we have over 200 patents on this technology. You know, as I said earlier, there is no quality of service on the internet. And so when you're on the open internet, you're at the whims of where the video is going to be switched from. And so if you're just using that as your backbone, quality can suffer. It's either latency. Sometimes there's lost packets. Sometimes it's quality. So broadcasters have chosen LTN or those other solutions for their quality needs. I mentioned the Fox feed out of Vatican City is an example. When you want it and you want to make sure it gets there at a high broadcast quality, people choose LTN.
Well, today we've been talking with Jeff Wataska, Vice President, Business Development, LTN Global Communications. If folks want to find out more about LTN, where should they go?
Our website is www.ltnglobal.com, or if anyone wants to talk to you, ask a question for me personally, you can send me an email at jwateska@ltnglobal.com.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us today. I certainly have learned a lot about LTN. Very exciting times. You know, it's kind of viewed by hobbyists in the satellite industry as, oh no, there goes another satellite feed that we can't watch. But like you said, this is the direction that the industry is going, and broadcasters are choosing these methods for a reason. And we really appreciate your insight into the LTN global communications, and kind of give us kind of an idea of why broadcasters are choosing this path. So thank you very much, Jeff, and we look forward to talking to you again sometime.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it.
Thanks to all that tuned in tonight. Join Satellite Guys Michael and Brian next Wednesday for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. And don't forget to like our page at facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio. Until next week, good night.